Welcome to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Andre Mendez, the Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer for the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Andre, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on the show. This is a first. I've never had the Broadcasting Board of Governors CIO on my show, so this is a little different. Being that we are all in the broadcast world, we have a lot to talk about. I like to start at the beginning with these conversations. The Broadcasting Board of Governors, what is your mission?
So the Broadcasting Board of Governors is responsible for all of the U.S. civilian broadcasts all over the world. It is composed of five broadcasting entities that comprise television, radio, online, social media, every single platform that you can think of. As a matter of fact, we operate the widest distribution portfolio of any Western media company. It is composed of the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, the Office of Cuban Broadcasting, and the Middle Eastern Broadcast Network.
So that's a huge variety, a lot going on from, and when you have to support that as the CIO and CTO, which we'll get to in a second. But when you talk about different stations, if you will, if we'll call them stations or different mission areas, it includes not just broadcasting, but I'm sure it includes online, digital, and broadcasting now, or is it just broadcasting over there only?
The full scope of operations. We operate everything from some of the largest shortwave stations in the world to Twitter and everything in between.
All right. Well, it's interesting because of how things have changed so much in the broadcasting world. I mean, I've been doing this now for about 8 years, and I've seen change in the 8 years. And I imagine you guys have been around, and you talk about Voice of America. You know, Radio Free Europe is probably since the 50s at least.
The Voice of America since about 1942, and then Radio Free Europe and some of the other ones at a later stage.
So imagine that's been just huge change. So as the CIO, as the CTO, let's talk about how you support that mission.
We have to make sure that that not only are we providing an IT infrastructure for the average run-of-the-mill back office functions, but we also have a very important role in fulfilling the needs for digital asset management that every broadcast organization has. In addition, I also have responsibility for the engineering part of the house. So I'm responsible for all of the distribution that we do via satellite, that we do via MPLS, that we do via fiber, and that operates across the world. We have transmitting stations all the way from Greenville, North Carolina, to the Mariana Islands in Tinian and Saipan. And they include a couple of properties in Europe, a couple of properties in Africa, a couple of properties in the Middle East, and well over 2,000 affiliate stations throughout the world.
From Federal News Radio's perspective, we have a few IT guys, we have a bunch of engineers. Your staff and your makeup must just be huge from a responsibility perspective, because you have people all over the world. And as you said, it's not just the back office typical stuff or the mission technology, but all the engineering side too. Is that add more complexity to your job as CIO slash CTO?
Oh, without a doubt. In the modern media world, the way that we aggregate, manipulate, package, and distribute content is really very akin to a supply chain environment. So what you're looking at is a myriad of teams that have very diverse skills and core competencies, but that must work in absolute unison in order to make sure that we can deliver the signals where we need to deliver them. So, I have people that are dealing with the desktop, which is incredibly important because a lot of the editing gets done there. I have network administrators and system administrators that are dealing with digital asset management systems. But then I also have to have satellite experts, shortwave experts, FM experts, medium wave experts, MPLS experts, all of the people that are dealing with our content delivery networks like CDNs like Akamai and Mirror Image. And it gets pretty complicated. It's a large organization with a tremendous portfolio.
Let's talk about the organization a little bit. How many federal employees do you have working for you under the CIO? How many contractors? What is your IT budget for 2016?
For 2016, we have approximately 140 folks in IT and engineering. We do not make extensive use of contractors, at least in here in the federal side, maybe 6 to 10. But then outside of the United States, I have several foreign service officers that are running our stations and about 500 or so foreign service nationals that actually operate our stations throughout the world. The budget for this year is about $181 million, and that also includes $15 million for our internet anti-censorship operation, which is the largest operation of its kind in the entire world.
I want to go back to the anti-censorship operation. Before we do that, only 6 or 10 contractors, is that the way the Broadcasting Board of Governors has always been? Or is that something that maybe you've changed over the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, is bringing more federal employees and fewer contractors?
It is somewhat different from the rest of the House. For example, the Voice of America has almost 600 contractors, so it's quite different. It's just that we have such very precise skills that we have two categories of requirements. One is people that can administer contracts with cloud-based providers, because we have made a tremendous migration to the cloud. And two are subject matter experts that we really are much better off hiring full-time than having to work on a contractual basis. There's just not a lot of people out there that know how to deal with shortwave stations and very large AM operations, especially in remote areas.
Sounds like you're talking what places like Social Security or IRS, when they talk about mainframe computers and COBOL, but you're dealing with AM, shortwave radio. You just don't see that talent, that skill set. And I know we'll talk about cloud in a little bit, and we may talk about workforce as well, but is that just an area where you, when you get somebody, you got to keep them because you know those skill sets are short in supply across the broad U.S.?
Yeah, there's not a lot of people that are specializing in that anymore. And also, you know, we have very good people. When you're looking at our shortwave stations, they are sort of the creme de la creme of just about any station that has ever been built in the world. And so we have people that are incredibly dedicated, that are incredibly competent, and that have a long corporate history with us of excellence. After all, we are operating a network that is in some cases 40, 50, 60 years old, and that is still performing at a 99.95 reliability. And that takes enormous dedication, but also tremendous knowledge.
And budget-wise, from an IT perspective, $181 million is a nice-sized budget. I mean, you guys are a fairly small agency. $15 million, you said, for the anti-censorship initiative. Talk a little bit about what that is and how that works.
In the past, as we saw, you know, regimes jamming shortwave broadcasts and jamming AM broadcasts and even jamming satellites for TV, today, what we're seeing is regimes being extremely concerned about the dissemination of information that they do not want their population to have access to. And so we're seeing these enormous efforts by states like China, Iran, Vietnam, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, to really curtail access to the internet, mostly through very, you know, sophisticated firewalls and censorship engines. Well, we actually operate the largest anti-censorship activity in the world, about $15 million. And with that money, we enable literally trillions of hits from behind those firewalls on a yearly basis. It's a constant cat and mouse game where, they increase the sophistication of their filtering algorithms, and we find a way to defeat them, and we go back and forth. But by and large, we're winning this particular war.
Very fascinating. I imagine we'll talk more about this a little bit as we go through. Sounds to me, though, like there's a little bit of white hat hackers going on here. You may not want to use that term, but it seems like you're playing the very similar game to the defensive side, where when you're worried about cybersecurity attacks on your network, you're defending and trying to increase your defenses, and then the offense comes in and they do something. It seems like the tables have turned a little bit.
Yeah, to a large degree. Although, you know, we would like to think that what we're doing is spreading freedom of information and access to the news that these people so desperately want. And so, it is sort of a white hacker mentality. It is a fantastic struggle, because we are outspent sometimes as much as 100-1 in terms of these type of activities. But it, like I said before, we keep winning, and with, you know, several trillions of hits a year, that this is a proven, extremely good investment for the American taxpayer.
Let's talk about your background a little bit. How long have you been the CIO/CTO at the Broadcasting Board of Governors? Where else have you worked inside and out of government?
So I have been here for about 6 years. Prior to that, I was 3 years at Special Olympics International. I have two people in my family with Down syndrome, and so I knew the CEO, and I thought it would be really a good mission to go over there and help them out in terms of transforming their organization. Prior to that, I was CIO and CTO at PBS at the network level as we executed the migration to digital television. And so I've had a couple of dabbles into the venture capital world because my background is in genetic engineering. But my timing wasn't so good on that. It was right around the bubble crash of 2000. So it's been an interesting ride. I first arrived in this country about 37 years ago from Portugal at 17. And interestingly enough, the reason why I'm working at the Broadcasting Board of Governors was because during the revolution in Portugal as a young kid, I listened with my parents and my family to shortwave radio, telling us what was going on, you know, in our country during the revolution as it happened. And so when the opportunity came to run this organization on a global basis from a technology standpoint, I couldn't say no.
Very interesting story. You see connections, interestingly, at the CIO level a lot, where we had one conversation a while ago, somebody who was a pilot and they got to work as the CIO at FAA, very similar, not quite as dramatic, but there's the interest merge and you get to kind of do the best of both worlds. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into some of those priorities, including that move to the cloud you talked about. My guest today is Andre Mendez, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Andre Mendez, Broadcasting Board of Governors, Chief Information Officer, and Chief Technology Officer. Now, Andre, before break, we talked a lot about how you support the mission of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, your background a little bit, your budget. You gave us a little bit of a hint of your priorities. You talked about cloud. Let's just jump right in. What are you trying to get done over the next 6 or 9 months?
The cloud for us is extremely important because of the size of this agency, which is relatively small. Our budget is a little deceiving because in those $180 million, you have all the engineering budget, all of the satellites and transmission stations, and also the rent for this building because I'm responsible for facilities. So, our IT budget is not that large. And so for us, it fulfills two very important functions. One is to increase our price performance ratio without a doubt by allowing us to leverage OPEX instead of CAPEX and leverage other people's expertise. We just cannot afford to have all of the experts in all of the technologies that we require from an IT standpoint. The second one, and almost as important, is fulfilling a very, very critical need for disaster recovery and business continuity. Nowadays, for the majority of my applications, regardless of where my personnel is in the world or the agency's personnel is in the world, they can access an overwhelming majority of our applications. I would venture to say, although I don't have hard data on this, that we are on the top three of the agencies with clouded applications. We were the first ones to really leverage Office 365 with the voicemail and SharePoint all in the cloud. We are in the process of moving all of our local file storage into OneDrive in the cloud. And we even are exploring with some of our master control for radio and television to actually operate that from the cloud, therefore removing them from this building, which was never designed to be a broadcast operation, quite honestly. And so those are very, very big priorities for us. The other one is, without a shadow of a doubt, cybersecurity. So interesting point here. When I first came on board in 2009, every single server in this agency was controlled by the Chinese cyber army. And they could have literally dropped this agency with one keystroke. Fortunately, they chose to never do so. But at the same time, we knew that they were exfiltrating literally, gigabyte upon gigabyte every day of information. We were able to eradicate them through a long-term exercise, about 4 months, to completely clean them out of our environment. But we continue to be target for some of the most sophisticated cyber hackers in the world, because we transmit into China, into Iran, into Vietnam, into Russia, into Chechnya, into North Korea. We are constantly being pounded by these individuals. So for us, cybersecurity is absolutely one of our top priorities, because we can't afford to fail in that endeavor. We have far too sophisticated people that are really trying to get into our data centers and wreak havoc with our operation.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible that every server was taken over by the Chinese. And just the fact is that they were taking so much data. When you came here...
6 years ago, in late 2009, literally in December 2009.
So just going back, you know, 6 years ago, 2009, when you came in and saw that your servers were just under attack, were being taken over, was your first idea was just unplug them from the wall and bring in new servers? I mean, but that seems a very expensive way to deal with the issue. But if you're that infected, you know, as they say, the only safe computer is one that's, you know, buried in a lead casing, unplugged from the wall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
No, it was an interesting proposition because shortly after discovering the infection, we also discovered that it had been a long-term persistent infection that had grown and grown and grown over time. So to a large degree, actually, one of our first objectives was to not let them know that we knew they were here because we wanted to draw up a cleanup plan that we would be able to operate and to implement, you know, in a very short period of time without major disruption to the operations of this agency, because after all, we are 24/365. But at the same time, ensuring that once we did it, that we could go all the way and not leave anything untouched, because the last thing we wanted is for them to have a revenge capability, let's say, from being excised from our environment, or to have some permanent residence that would later grow on at a later stage and be undetected because they had become somewhat more sophisticated. And so we needed to make sure that we did it right, that we did it thoroughly, but at the same time that we did it stealthily so that they did not know that we knew they were here.
So without getting into too many of the sensitive details, I realize that you may not be able to talk too much about it. Can you give me a general sense of how you went about this? Because, again, every agency, you know, the old, it seems like an old adage now, if there's two kinds of people, those who've been hacked and know it and those who've been hacked and don't know it. Mm-hmm. How did you ensure... Give me some of the best practices that you used, if you can, even just at a high level.
For one thing, we had a very, you know, unsophisticated patching practice and really hadn't paid attention to a lot of the basic situations with password protections, password changes, and just typical maintenance that you have to have, even in environments that are not constantly being threatened. So when we went about cleaning it up, we had to make sure that we identified every server, that we were ready to deploy images on a massive basis and very quickly, and that we also could get to every single workstation. We developed fairly sophisticated password generation and dissemination protocols. And then we dedicated about 72 hours for a all-hands-on-deck effort that saw us replace literally hundreds of servers and completely re-image, over 1,000 workstations. So it was a complete, you know, to-the-wall effort by everybody in the team with a very precise program plan to take it from 0 to 100 in 72 hours.
And did you know that it worked once you were, you know, after that 72 hours? Did you feel like, okay, we'll know if it worked in 24 more hours? And did it take time? When did you know you had done the right thing?
We believed that at first we were successful. But at the same time that we had been preparing for this, we had been installing intrusion detection systems. We had started exploring things like, whitelisting of applications. And we had engaged some help from some consultants with some very specific engines to look at our traffic on a constant basis. We were also one of the first agencies to take advantage of the Einstein MTIPS, traffic, monitoring. And so we were quite sure that over time, if we saw some more of those activities, that they would be brought to our attention. We did a lot of DNS sinkholing. And so we were able to identify when those beacons were starting to try to call home again, because some of them remained dormant for a while. But then when they came to life again, which I think is part of their protocol, they were going to very specific IPs and IP ranges that we had been able to identify and that we had sinkholed so that we could detect them, go to the origin of the beacon, and clean it up. But, a studious process, quite honestly, that kept me awake at night.
When you brought this to the board to talk to and say, hey, we have this problem, did they get it back in 2009? Did they understand how serious this was? And was there money, was there personnel, was there resources to get it done? Did you get that kind of support?
They knew what was going on. We kept them informed. I didn't ask for additional resources because I felt that the plan that we had put together and some of the money that we had been able to move away from other operations was going to be enough. They were very concerned, as you can imagine, and they were very relieved when it finally, the cleanup effort came to fruition. But they were fully supportive of our effort. As a new CIO at the time, you know that you get a little bit of a honeymoon, right? And they understood that we were basically trying to clean up a situation that had been quite messy.
That's a heck of a first 100 days, if you will, that you got to see. You mentioned some DHS programs, Einstein, MTIPS. I imagine now continuous diagnostics and mitigation is part of that. Talk a little bit about where those now fit into your overall cybersecurity plans.
No, they're an integral part. They're an integral part, and they will continue to be. We still have a substantial number of intrusion detection systems. We've continued to expand the use of whitelisting. And we have a very aggressive patching program. All of our computers, all of our workstations are patched on a monthly basis, often within hours of all the patches being released by all of the different vendors, manufacturers. And we are absolutely religious about it. Because, again, we are under such tremendous constant attack that, any little leeway, can lead into tremendous danger. So we're very, very proactive.
Now, I want to go back to the cloud, but before we do that, one of the things about patching is that standard image, or a lot of times I hear about, thin clients or zero clients. Are you down either of those paths, meaning you have a configuration management program where you put a patch in, you can test it in a sandbox, know it won't hurt the systems, and then you can deploy it widely very quickly?
For us, it's an absolute prerequisite because a lot of the servers that we are patching in workstations are running our mission-critical applications that actually have a very, both complex and fragile technology stack from a driver standpoint. And so we have to make sure that that every single patch is tested before being applied, which puts a tremendous onus on the team. But at the same time, they've developed all the protocols, all of the test beds to make sure that we can do that safely. But it is a constant struggle, let me tell you. The amount of resources that are consumed by our security program are not insignificant at all.
You talked about passwords. We hear passwords are, if we can get rid of passwords. Michael Daniel from the White House talked about killing the passwords dead. Or you guys have moved to two-factor authentication, HSPD-12, the smart ID cards. Are you guys down that path as well?
We're in the process of doing that. Unfortunately, also, when I first came on board, there were no smart IDs whatsoever. We are now at about 95% of the agency. So within the next couple of months, we will be implementing that on a full-scale basis.
And the people who are using them, are they doing it just for log on to their network, log on to the computer or application too? Or is that kind of further down the path? Meaning, let's start with getting onto the network and then we'll maybe connect the smart ID card to the specific application, the roles and responsibilities piece.
Well, one of the things we've been very aggressively doing, because of how significant it is from a workflow standpoint, is to enable one sign-on. Right, through a lot of our systems. So getting that signature into the network at first gives you access to a substantial number of applications, only some very specific ones that we require, again, additional entry. So, once we get it on the network, I think we half of the battle will be won.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about cloud a little bit. My guest is Andre Mendez, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Chief Information Officer, and Chief Technology Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Andre Mendez, the CIO and the CTO of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Before break, we're talking a lot about cybersecurity. Another big priority you mentioned also was cloud computing. You guys have moved, SharePoint to the cloud. I think you've also taken advantage of Azure, the Azure cloud, Microsoft 365. Talk a little bit about how the benefits you're seeing from that, and then going forward, where else are you looking to implement cloud?
For an organization like us that operates on a global basis, to have the ability to have all of your employees, regardless of where they are, accessing email, voicemail, SharePoint, and all of its related intranet applications, and also all of their files without having to avail themselves of VPNs is a tremendous advantage. So from that standpoint, it has been terrific. The other issue is, quite honestly, the maintenance of all the servers. Nowadays, if you're running that type of application internally, not only do you have a substantial number of servers to deal with the traffic, but also a substantial number of test servers and disaster recovery services. And before you know it, you know, that type of application will take you 25, 30, 35, 40 servers and all of the related administration. The costs are tremendous. And quite honestly, we can't keep up with the latest technologies. So what we do is we leverage these vendors and their built-in technology, their built-in security, because after all, it is their business case that is on the line for them from a security standpoint. And we have one less set of applications to worry about. So that has allowed me to reduce my staff on an ongoing basis and to provide with a much higher level of availability than I likely could if I was to run all of these things internally. We now have CRM on the cloud as well. We have a web analytics on the cloud. Our payroll is processed by another agency. Our HR system is another agency. Our financial systems are another agency. We have federated authentication run on the cloud as well. We're leveraging Azure and Amazon for a variety of content management in the cloud and storage. And so I'm going to continue that trend. Every single application that absolutely does not have to be here, by virtue of, for example, handling high-definition video, that's very difficult to do on the cloud. But if it doesn't have that type of requirements from a storage standpoint or latency standpoint, it's going to go into the cloud. As a matter of fact, even for video, we are now doing hierarchical storage, and the last step is being moved to the cloud, to a data center in Colorado, somewhere under a mountain, where we have the long-term preservation, but at the same time, we have the ability to, on a very quick basis, turn it around and bring it into the house if we need access to a digital asset. So for us, it's almost a no-brainer. But I got to tell you, that disaster recovery component is just as important as the actual functionality it brings to the table to start with.
Talk about putting so much in the cloud, and you mentioned the security piece. Was that ever a concern for you? Did you ever say, well, we can't put that in the cloud? Or did you ever get pushback from people who maybe were concerned about putting, whether it was CRM or whether it was putting content in the cloud because it was, well, we got to be able to touch and feel that on the server, so to speak?
Well, because of the situation that I inherited from a security standpoint, there was not a lot of people that were willing to stand up and say, hey, we can do it better than the experts in the industry. So I had a little bit of an advantage from that standpoint. But I think that that is true today as well. I don't think that all of the agencies in the United States federal government can go out and hire the absolute best people from a security standpoint. One, we can't afford it. And two, they won't come to the federal government with the salaries that we are able to pay because these are very much on-demand skills. So when I look at a company like, for example, Microsoft or Oracle, they have the ability to hire the absolute best people to deploy them on a global basis, right, so that all of us can benefit from that. And it fits into their business schema, and their entire bottom line is dependent on it. So I know that these people are going to go to the ends of the world to ensure that their infrastructure is not compromised. Are they always going to be successful? No, but they have a much better chance at having success than I do as a small federal government agency that cannot afford the best people in the world. It's that simple.
From a cost-saving standpoint, I remember when we first started talking about the cloud in the federal community, it was all about saving money, saving money, saving money. What I'm getting now from CIOs, it's less about saving money, more about the agility, the reduced complexity. Which side are you on? Do you see the money savings, but also the agility? Or is it just all about that agility and reduced complexity for you internally?
They go together. They absolutely go together. My speed of deployment increased tremendously, even in-house when I went to a virtualized environment, right? And so when I go to a virtualized environment in the cloud, that is multiplied. The ability to provision a server in minutes without having to worry about procurements, you know, from a hardware standpoint, and then all of the applications, the patching and everything else. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's a complete no-brainer. I have been a tremendous advocate of both virtualization and cloud computing for a long time. We did virtualization at PBS back in the late 1990s, and I clouded all of the Special Olympics infrastructure, you know, back in 2006. In total, the whole thing, the whole entire IT department. And so for me, it's an absolute no-brainer. There are so many advantages and so few disadvantages that I can think of that it just doesn't make sense not to do it in the most aggressive manner.
I'm sure back in 2006 and before that, it wasn't called cloud. It was called managed services or something else, or the ASPs, right?
Right. Yeah, you know, they had a lot of names for them. But then again, you know, I'm an old mainframe guy, so we used to have timeshare systems, and I was very comfortable with them then.
Talk a little bit about the savings, if you can. I mean, have you baselined what you were paying, and then when you move to the cloud, what you're paying now? And is it, again, you're getting more for your money or less money?
I am getting far more for my money and for less money. So it works across the entire realm. For example, from a personnel standpoint, we are now doing 3-for-1. For every 3 people that retire, we end up hiring 1 person back. So my staff over time, just with attrition, has been reduced by over 15%. My entire budget for IT and engineering has gone from over $200 million just a few years ago to $181 million, and $15 million of that is for the internet anti-censorship, which effectively leaves me with a budget of about $166 million, a reduction of about $34 million or 20% over what it was 5 years ago. So, you know, this is very significant for this agency because it can put its money where it wants to put its money, which is in content production, manipulation, and dissemination. And it's a great value for the taxpayer.
Does it concern you that your hiring rate of 1 for every 3 who leave in terms of for your office, does that concern you? Because you still have projects to manage. You still need a different set of skills to manage cloud services or cloud applications. You know, many government agencies say, I'd like to take those 2 other people and move them into a data analytics, for instance, or data scientist area, or some other type of IT profession that's not systems administrator or someone who watches blinking lights?
Well, a lot of it was driven by our budget circumstance, because between 2009 and 2014, we had effective loss of purchasing power of about $115 million. Between inflation and some budget cuts precipitated by, you know, some of the budget issues in the federal government, we were effectively losing a substantial amount of our funding in real terms, while at the same time, our portfolio of applications and distribution continued to, you know, multiply, because in the media world, 5 years, 6 years, it's a lifetime. It's a lifetime. And so, you know, we couldn't afford to stand still. We had to take a very aggressive cost-cutting, you know, measures in hand, because we want to continue to provide value where our core competency is. And this agency does not exist to run servers. This agency does not exist to run storage systems. This agency exists to provide information that is direly needed by some of the most underserved people in the world, and to provide it in a timely basis, in a factual basis, and by whichever means the people that we are targeting want and can consume it. So that's where I want to spend my money.
And I think a lot of agencies are seeing that through the changing of how they buy, manage IT, is that they, we can push this to the mission side. I think that's important. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about cloud a little bit. My guest is Andre Mendez, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is Andre Mendez, the CIO and the CTO of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. A couple other priorities maybe you didn't mention, but let's just go over quickly. Big data. Every agency seems to be awash in data. How are they managing it? What are you guys doing about the big data deluge? Is that a big problem for you guys?
Actually, no. We don't have a lot of big data issues, but what we have is a lot of big file issues. And let me explain. As we do the migration from regular television to HDTV, because our markets are now adopting that in the Middle East, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, right? We have tremendous storage and networking challenges, right? The files are four times bigger. And so we have to transport them over the satellite. Satellites in transponder space is extremely expensive. We have to store them. We have to archive them. And so that represents a whole slew of big file challenges. As far as big data is concerned, I really don't have a lot because of all of the outsourcing that I do. So I use the analytics that the vendors provide me. And supplement them a little bit with in-house, ad hoc custom reporting. But otherwise, again, I leverage their capabilities because they have the ability to do products for all of their customer base, and I can leverage that.
And as you mentioned, you also have HR, financial management. Both of those are outsourced to other federal agencies, so you can depend on them for that decision-making data as well. You can, whatever reports they're running, you can take that, give to your, obviously, the board and the CEO of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. That's another, a benefit of the shared services.
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, we want to concentrate on our core capabilities, competence, and mission requirements, right? We are not here to run all of these infrastructure businesses. So the more than I can have somebody else do it, and the better it is for the agency.
Another common priority I hear from CIOs is mobility, whether it's laptops, or now people are moving obviously to tablets or smartphones. What do you got? How mobile is your workforce, and are they asking, are they begging, or do they need the different computers, whether again tablets, smartphones, or what have you?
Absolutely. We have a very aggressive move to that, especially because we're moving into an open space environment. We're encouraging a lot more teleworking and even hoteling, and of course that is much better done in a mobile environment. Also, because a lot of our people are journalists, every single one of them is now equipped with a smartphone, which effectively gives them the capability to report, be citizen reporters, regardless of where they are, at a drop of a hat, right? When you have, an iPhone or an Android phone or Windows phone that can capture video at 1080i for HD, and costs you almost nothing. It becomes a tremendous weapon. We are doing now Facebook Live sessions from all over this building on cell phones, from Congress, from the White House, from state, from wherever our journalists are, because the capability is there. And so we leverage as a tremendous asset the tremendous demand, and we are trying to meet that demand.
Do you have pilots ongoing, or have you already moved out with certain tablets and laptops and smartphones? Where are you in that kind of process?
Oh, no, we're aggressively out. We're doing an aggressive deployment of surfaces now for our staff. They're just, the capability that they bring to the table is tremendous. And they allow me to also have a built-in disaster recovery scenario. So if you can imagine, I have somebody working in this building with a Surface, tablet, computer, whatever you want to call it. If something happens to this building, because all of the data is in the cloud, and this individual has a computer that can go anywhere at a drop of a hat and operate from anywhere in the world and have access to everything that they have in their desktop, then I have a built-in disaster recovery capability, at least for some of my functions. I only wish that I could do that with video editing, but that time will come as well.
I think the tablets aren't quite heavy enough, if you will. They don't have enough compute power to do editing yet, because we have the same problem. We have laptops, and we asked about moving to tablets at one time, and they said our engineers, our IT folks, said it's just not quite there yet. So I think it's coming. One thing that, as I was doing research, you guys are connected to the State Department in some ways. You work closely with them. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit from an IT standpoint. How closely do you work with the IT side of State Department? Or do you have some shared services with the State Department, whether it's not necessarily the back office, but maybe the mission side, whether it comes to sharing bandwidth or sharing secure networks? Talk a little bit about your relationship.
Actually, very little, although we do carry the State Department channel on our satellites. and distributed all over the world to all of the embassies. So we certainly provide them with that. Interestingly enough, we do collaborate a substantial amount with State Department on the internet anti-censorship environment, because they have efforts at AID, for example, and DRL, the two departments of state, departments. And we collaborate with them on a constant basis. We meet with them on a monthly basis to make sure that there's no duplication of efforts, that there's no duplication of expenditures, and that the programs that we run and the programs that they run are in constant unison, so that we can maximize, the amount of work that we can get through with the taxpayers' money that we are allocated for that particular purpose. So it works out very well.
Do you have close relationships with other federal agencies? I mean, your mission on your own is very specific, mm-hmm. but whether it's state or defense or USAID or others, is there a collaboration from an IT perspective among some of those other agencies as well? Or is it because of the road you're on, not many other people travel the same road?
There is a certain uniqueness to us. We do rely on other agencies to do a lot of our back office, so without a doubt. And we collaborate with other agencies to make sure that our strategic priorities are the right ones for the public diplomacy efforts that we are constantly undertaking. After all, we are part of the public diplomacy armamentarium, so to speak, of the federal government. So we work very closely with OMB, we work very closely with the Hill, we even work closely with NSC to make sure that, we have the proper targets from an information standpoint. We are, constantly dealing with challenges from a propaganda standpoint, whether it is Putin with the invasion of Crimea and all of the situation surrounding the former Soviet Union periphery, whether it is ISIS in the Middle East, creating havoc and having a tremendous propaganda machine, whether it is the Chinese and South China Sea and all the problems that arise from that. So we have to make sure that we're coordinated with the rest of public diplomacy, but with the caveat that we fulfill our mission with absolutely fact-based objective journalism. So there is a firewall that separates all of these activities from some of the other intelligence activities, for example, and we never cross that wall. We are journalists, and the mission that we accomplish is by providing the people in these repressed societies with objective, fact-based journalism that allows them to make decisions on their lives, on the way they want to react inside of their country, and on the news they hear from the rest of the world.
All right, I know we're almost out of time. Before I let you go, I know a lot of vendors listen to the show. You don't use a lot of vendors, but still they'll be very interested in a lot of work you're doing. What kind of recommendations do you have? How do you like, from a CIO, CTO perspective, how do you like vendors to work with your office?
Well, for me, complete transparency. We are way past the hype of selling. I don't need solutions that are supposed to work. I need solutions that work. Because I'm in the broadcast industry, and because broadcast and IT have become so interlaced, to me, technology stack, collaboration between vendors to ensure that their programs, their hardware, their software is absolutely compatible, 24/7 rock solid, is the most important thing that they can bring to the table. When I have certified interfaces that perform day in and day out without any problems, I know that I've found a cadre of vendors that I can work with on an ongoing basis.
All right, very cool. You have a lot of great stuff going on. I'm sure we could talk longer, but unfortunately we're out of time. My guest has been Andre Mendez, the Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer for the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Andre, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec and DLT Solutions. The entire show is available on demand on federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask CIO.